books play an incredibly important role in social change, and they have ever since the invention and development of the printing press. And times of great social upheaval have often either accompanied or shortly followed times of explosions of publishing on those issues. And it's one of the ways these days culture propagates. And so in that sense, I want to talk a little bit about some of the books that have been very important to me in my development as a thinker and writer and a human being, most of all. And I think where I want to start is with, in this case, is with Joseph Campbell, even though I think by now there's much of his work that I don't agree with. But he was very important to me in my early 20s for showing that there's a line of his that I can forgive him everything I disagree with, or I can ignore everything I disagree with because this part was so good, where he said that if the rules of a social order, if the mythology, the dominant mythology makes sense to you, then you have a path of meaning that has been set out for you. So that, for example, if Catholicism works for you and if communion means something to you, then there is a path to meaning in your life. Likewise, if the signs and symbols of capitalism work for you, if the American dream works for you, then there is a path of some sort of meaning set out for you. And if those signs, and I don't like the meaning of capitalism or Catholicism for that matter, but that's neither here nor there. The people who do believe have a well-worn path of meaning. And if the signs don't work for you, then meaning is as crucial to us in its own way in our lives as is food and water and air. And if the signs of society don't give you, if you don't find meaning in them, then you have to set out on what Campbell called the hero journey, which we can also make it the heroine journey. But in any case, this journey, which is about going out into the wilds of the unconscious, really, and finding meaning, and then bringing that meaning, that wisdom gained through these travails back into your community as a gift. And that was desperately important to me when I was in my early 20s and really confused because the signs and symbols of the culture weren't making sense to me. And it was so wonderful to read someone articulating that process and articulating why, for me and for many of the people I knew, the 20s were so horrible, is because that's a very difficult process of going out and finding yourself and finding who you are in the world. That path, some traditions call that the razor's edge, because there's this well-worn path of meaning from Islam, Judaism, Christianity, capitalism, well-worn path. And on the other hand, this other path, you're on it alone, it seems, and a misstep can mean death. And so that was very comforting and encouraging for me to read. So then let's fast forward a few years to in my late 20s, and I'm starting to become an activist and a writer. And one day I was in the library in Spokane, Washington, and a book jumped off the shelf at me, and it was Neil Everndon's The Natural Alien. This was the first book I read that didn't take this culture's utilitarian perspective or perspective that the world is here for us to use. It didn't take that as a given. And as I was reading this book, I felt this huge weight lift off my shoulders as I thought, I'm not crazy. The culture's crazy. I got a reinforcement of the things I'd known my whole life were true, but which everything in this culture teaches us are not true, that trees have lives as meaningful to them as mine is to me and yours is to you. This was the first book I read that led me in that direction. And there's a beautiful piece in there that I think that Everton got from David Ehrenfeld about how, what do you do if after giving this impassioned defense of some creature, the person you're talking to says, well, what good is it? And so the only answer you can really give them is, well, what good are you? And not to insult them or offend them, but to show them how stupid it is to measure someone else by their economic value, especially to you. And for me, this whole culture's worldview fell apart on reading that book. And that was a tremendous gift. And at the time, I was a young writer searching for ways, venues to get published, you know, publishing in all sorts of little magazines. And I had done some interviews, and I'm not nearly this forward usually, but I got this crazy idea, and I called up Neil Everton's university and said to his secretary, I would like to interview him. I'm not normally that bold, but I did. And the secretary said, well, he's not here right now, but here's his home number. And oh my God, I called him at home. I can't believe I did that. And Neil Everton said, you know, I would be glad to give you an interview, but I have to tell you, there's somebody way more important than I am, who is John Livingston. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I'll read his book, and then if I like, I'll interview him too. And John Livingston's book, The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation, was very important to me too. It was the first place I encountered something I say all the time now, which is that evolution, natural selection, is primarily based on cooperation, not competition. He makes a very strong case for that. And at first, when I read that, I was thinking, this is crazy. No, that can't be. It has to be based on competition. And I had read something that it takes people 10 years to change their minds. And it took me a couple years to change my mind on that one, but it metabolized its way through my system. Another thing that John Livingston says is he, and you'll recognize this from my own work, that I've taken this from him, or I've metabolized what he had to say about this, that the problems we face are not fundamentally rational. And he says it differently. What he says is, you cannot argue someone who wants to destroy the world, you can't argue them out of it, because wanting to protect the world is a state of being. And some of us love the world and some of us don't. And I think that's very true. And so that book was very important. And then another book that I got introduced to through Neil Everton's The Natural Alien was R.D. Lang's The Politics of Experience. Absolutely crucial book. And I have to also just say that R.D. Lang was himself very abusive. But leaving that aside, or not leaving that aside, it was very interesting because his books are about really the psychology, the fundamental part of The Politics of Experience, the fundamental point of that book is that people act according to their experience. And if you can understand their experience, you can understand their behavior. The point is, no matter what anybody does, they have it fully rationalized, and they believe it's the right thing to do, even if it's a terrible thing. Ted Bundy would not have done what he did if it didn't make sense to him at the time. No matter what you're doing, it makes sense to you at the time, or you don't do it. This is certainly true for me. I have done terrible things in my life, and I have had them fully rationalized. We all do that. And so much of R.D. Lang's book is about how this culture turns us into destructive beings. Very, very important book. Another book that was really important to my development, I'm going to back up a little bit because I actually read this one before the others, is back in 1986 or so, for Christmas, I asked my mom if she would give me a copy of Eric Fromm's The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. And I don't know. It makes me laugh that I asked for that for Christmas. And it is an absolutely crucial book. It talks about how and why some cultures are destructive and some cultures are not. And it talks about the psychological and social means by which a destructive culture propagates. And it talks about something else that has become a theme in all of my work, which is that this culture suffers from necrophilia. It is driven by a death urge. And Eric Fromm really lays that out very well. So another book that was very, very important to me was Susan Griffin's Woman in Nature. That also talks extensively about this culture's necrophilia. And it's a beautifully written book, and it is absolutely crucial to my style as well as a writer. That I read that book, and I read The Memory of Fire trilogy by Eduardo Galeano right about the same time. And both of those books are written in a nonlinear fashion where instead of making a case, you present a perspective and then you present another perspective, and you can set these in stark contrast to each other. And at first it might seem jarring, but by the end of the book, I'm going to switch over from talking about books to talking about visual arts here, that it's like a mosaic. And when you step back a little bit, you see the pattern emerge. And I remember reading both of those books and thinking that they were the most stunning and extraordinary books I'd read in my life. And I wanted to learn how to do that. And this, for young writers, this is a lesson here, that this is how it works, I think, in the real world, is that I want to write like Susan Griffin in Woman in Nature or Eduardo Galeano in Memory of Fire trilogy. And I work on it, but I end up not writing like them. What happens is that a language older than words emerges with my style about 5 or 6 or 7 years later, that I metabolized theirs and my own version of it emerged. So that those books are very important to me. Another book that was very important to my development was Jane Caputi's The Age of Sex Crime. That book is about how serial sex killers often mutilate the breasts and genitals of women. And she suggests that is one cultural manifestation of the hatred of women, and that another manifestation would be the unnecessary hysterectomies and unnecessary breast surgeries that are mutilating the bodies of women. So the culture has this desire to mutilate the bodies of women, and serial sex killers do it one way, the medical industry does it another way, and advertising does it another way by emphasizing women's body parts abstracted from the whole or cut off from the whole. And pornography certainly does that another way as well. She would argue, or my understanding of her argument would be, that those are all part of a cultural manifestation underlying and coming out in these different ways. Another series of books that were very important to me were Mary Daly's books. And the reason I'm smiling is because Mary Daly, I mean, she her stuff is incredibly important, and her understanding of patriarchy's necrophilia is absolutely crucial. And the reason I'm smiling is because she also writes in sort of a nonlinear fashion, and she has a very distinct style, and I love her style. But I put her in this way, in the same category as Thomas Wolfe, that I love Thomas Wolfe's line-by-line writing too, and I can only read like 3 or 4 pages at a time, and then I'm full. And it's the same with Mary Daly, that I love her work, but I can't read a book in 2 days. I can only read 3 pages, and then I'm full. It's like eating the richest cheesecake you've ever had in your life. You know, it's a few bites, and I was like, I really want more, but I just can't do it. So Mary Daly has that. It's like, I take her in very small bites, but I do love her. Then Andrea Dworkin was very important to me with her, with the urgency and articulation, and the urgency and the brilliant articulation of men's hatred of women. And the, as one friend of mine says, that Andrea Dworkin provides the Rosetta Stone for understanding this culture's destructiveness in terms of the way she ties together the patriarchal urge to violate and sexual sadism, and how patriarchy has brilliantly tied one of the most beautiful and wonderful of natural urges, which is towards sex, has tied that to destructiveness, and tied that to sadism, and tied that to violation of others, and how that is a really powerful combination. That was very important to me. Some other books important to my development. See, one of the problems with making lists like this sort of impromptu is that I know I'm going to forget some very important books. Robert J. Lifton's The Nazi Doctors was incredibly important to my thinking, and his fundamental thesis there, there's many parts of it. One of them is that if you're participating in a larger destructive system, well, one of his points was that many of the Nazi doctors did what they could to try to help the Jews in the inmates in the prisons. And they would hide them from selection officers. They would give them an extra scrap of food. They would let them rest for a day or two, and they would do everything they could, except for the most important thing of all, which is to question the existence of the death camp itself and to question working them to death, the inmates to death, gassing them to death. They wouldn't question that larger structure. And this was really important to me, not only because it's important, but also because I see it in environmentalism. There's so many environmentalists will do everything they can to protect this or that piece of ground, except for questioning the existence of the larger death camp culture that is working the planet to death, that is gassing the planet to death, that is committing mass murder against the planet. And so they won't question. It taught me the importance of questioning the larger assumptions that are the real authorities of any culture. And another thing that's very important about Lifton is that he talks about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to have what he called a claim to virtue. You have to convince yourself that what you're doing is not harmful, but in fact beneficial. So the Nazis weren't committing mass murder and genocide. They were purifying the Aryan race. They weren't waging aggressive war, but they were creating Lebensraum for themselves. The American settlers weren't committing genocide and mass murder. They were manifesting their destiny. You know, we see this everywhere today, not committing genocide and ecocide, instead developing natural resources, and not toxifying what's left of the world, but instead going green with solar and wind. You see this everywhere. And it's true on a personal level too. I mean, one of the things I've said for years is that I've never once in my life been a jerk. Never once. Every single time that I have objectively been a jerk, I've had it fully rationalized. And I've had a claim to virtue. We always have claims to virtue. Everybody does. This goes back to the Artie Lang. You act according to the way you experience the world. And so those are some important books. And, oh, how did I almost see? I almost forgot Lewis Mumford. Lewis Mumford, one of his central insights is that, well, one thing I certainly got from Mumford is that the other day on Facebook, somebody posted, what is the worst invention, the most destructive invention humans have ever come up with? And I don't remember what other people were saying, you know, gunpowder, the plow, I don't remember what, television, I don't know what they were saying. The plow is certainly one of the most destructive inventions humans have ever created. But I think the most destructive invention, and I got this straight from Mumford, is what Mumford called the mega machine, which is a top-down, bureaucratic, military-style organization. That's the corporation. That is the Egyptian forces that would build the pyramid. It's the army. And it's an extraordinary thing to be able to get a million people together and get them to aim for one task. That's an extraordinary accomplishment. I mean, normally, you can't get a half dozen people together to try to plan a barbecue. And I mean, I very much disagree with the people who think that humans are fundamentally evil or fundamentally destructive. I don't agree with that. And that's a topic of a whole nother discussion. But what I do think is that humans are fundamentally contentious. And I think we squabble. And I think we find ways to pick at each other and to not get along. And indigenous peoples have had to come up with ways to get along. And that's one thing. But they weren't very efficient in terms of aiming people toward how do you get people all to build a pyramid, a giant pyramid that's going to be a tomb for some guy. How do you do that? Well, for that, you need what Lewis Mumford called a mega machine. It's a social organization in which individual human beings or non-human beings are popped in like cogs in a machine. I think that's the most destructive invention humans have ever made. And Lewis Mumford helped articulate that as well as many other things. Lewis Mumford, there's a couple people I want to mention that I'm not mentioning. One of them is Daniel Quinn. And I'm saying this because Daniel Quinn has written really important books, but the reason he was not influential to me is because I didn't read him until 2000 or 1999. That had I read Daniel Quinn when I was in 1989 instead of 1999, he would have been very influential to me. So me not mentioning Daniel Quinn is no insult to Daniel Quinn. It's merely I didn't encounter him until later. And there's other writers, I'm sure, who are the same way. Vine Deloria was very influential to me in terms of helping me to understand, helping me to decolonize and to understand that many of the assumptions that we take for granted are the perspective of our worldview. And a great example of that would be the notion that competition runs natural selection, that I have talked to really, really intelligent people who can see many things, but they can't see their way past. They still think that evolution is based on the same underlying principles as capitalism. And that's not because they believe in capitalism. It's because they've been so inculcated into the culture. And Vine Deloria does a tremendous job of deconstructing that, or did. He's dead now. I know I'm missing some very important books. Let me look at a list real quick and see if there's anybody else I need to add to the list for now. Okay, there's two more that I want to mention. One of them is William Catton's book, Overshoot, which is just a fabulous explanation of overshoot and carrying capacity. He's a bit too mechanistic for me, but that's okay. He brings together, if you want to understand carrying capacity, read William R. Catton, and then we can talk. That was one. And then the other person I want to mention is Jack Forbes' book, Columbus and Other Cannibals. And Jack Forbes, the thesis of Columbus and Other Cannibals is that the problem is not merely a social system. The problem is not merely that capitalism is exploitative. I mean, this culture is crazy. It is so absolutely insane. And I've been trying for my entire adult life to understand how you could kill a planet that is your only home. And how, I understand what R.D. Lang said about if you experience the world in a certain way, but that doesn't alter the fact that they're killing the planet. And that's really nuts. I understand claims to virtue. I understand Mary Daly saying that there's only one religion in the world right now, and that's patriarchy, and the patriarchy is necrophilia. I understand that. I get it. But that doesn't alter the fact that they're killing the planet. It doesn't make any sense. It's they're not just wiping out one species. They are killing the planet. And Jack Forbes' book helped me understand that his thesis is that the problem is a spiritual illness with a physical and spiritual vector. And that's not a metaphor. That's not that, they are spiritually ill in some sort of metaphorical or spiritual sense. But instead, it's like if I have the flu and I cough, then the little germs can go out and you could possibly then get the flu. His thesis is that there is a wettigo illness, a cannibal sickness, a spiritual illness that causes you to have to consume the souls of others, to become a slaver, to become a capitalist, to become a pornographer. And that if you have this illness, you become a vampire. And this illness is highly contagious, and it's spread through physical contact. It is spread through atrocity. It is spread through writing. It is spread through television. And it's turning the world into zombies. And actually, there's one more that I want to mention, one more book. And this is Judith Herman's Trauma and Recovery. And it's a fabulous book. Judith Herman is one of the people who came up with the diagnosis complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, we all know PTSD is, you know, if somebody has something terrible happen to them once, like my mom and I were in a car wreck, and the car wreck happened on a terrible car wreck. She broke her neck, became functionally blind, and it happened on a dark and rainy night. And so when I have in a canyon, and so when I have driven with my mom through a canyon, especially on a dark and rainy night, she gets very nervous and wants me to go very, very slow. Also, I didn't hear this in the accident, but my mom said that what she heard was a loud bang. What happened was, it was a very dark night, and there was a semi truckload of plywood with a black tarp or a dark green tarp had overturned across the road, and I didn't see it, and I hit it going 55. I didn't hear anything. My mom said she heard a loud bang. So now she can be just watching television, and if there is a certain loud bang, she has a too strong startle response to this. That's PTSD. Or let's say a woman is sexually assaulted in a certain make and model of car. That make and model of car she may not want to get into that type of car again because of the triggers associated with it. That's PTSD. But Judith Herman asked, what if someone does not merely have one incident or a couple incidents happen to them that are highly traumatizing, but instead what happens if a person is held in captivity, is a prisoner, or is kidnapped, or is raised under conditions of domestic violence, or is married to someone or is living with someone who is abusing them? That's a form of captivity. And she said different things happen. You get those regular PTSD triggers, and then there are further triggers too. You can, especially if you're raised in it, but also if you're in prison, you can come to believe that all relationships are hierarchical. And they're based on the strong exploiting the weak and the weak getting by as they can. There can be disturbances in intimacy such that you are too scared to be intimate, by which I don't just mean be sexual, I mean be intimate. You can come to believe that there is no such thing as a fully mutual relationship. And that's all brilliant work and incredibly important work. And that book, like many of these others, saved my life. But there's something else going on with that book too, which is that it's very clear to me that we have an entire culture suffering from complex post-traumatic stress disorder. That this notion that the strong exploit the weak and the weak get by as they can, and all relationships are hierarchical and there is no such thing as a fully mutual relationship, That's the selfish gene theory. That's also queer theory. That is the, this culture's philosophies are rationalizations of this culture's complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And I would never have been able to write that had I not read Judith Herman, and had I not jumped from her descriptions of that to the larger culture. And so there's a couple ways I want to end. One of them is to just recommend these books and recommend these authors. And the other is to give this as a living example of the importance of discourse and the importance of writing, because, you know, I don't know how many copies Neil Everdon sold of The Natural Alien. And I don't know how many copies. I know that Andrea Dworkin did not make her money as a writer. Most writers don't make any money. And I don't think Susan Griffin's Woman of Nature sold all that well. And writers don't get our payment in money for the most part. But what is true is that had Neil Everdon not written The Natural Alien, I would not have written my books. And if I hadn't written my books, then there might be somebody out there who won't write theirs or who won't make that social change. So what writing is holding hands through time. And, you know, it is true again that whatever else Andrea Dworkin did or did not get paid, my work wouldn't be what it is without her work. And that's how social change takes place in the real world. Social change doesn't take place. Okay, so I just interviewed somebody a couple days ago. He's a longtime organizer, Ramsey Kanaan, organizer, publisher. And one of the things he wanted to emphasize is the difference between mobilizing and organizing. And he said, you can mobilize on Facebook and you can mobilize a lot of people. And they mobilized millions of people to march against George Bush going into war. But mobilizing is not organizing. You can mobilize with a superficial call to action. But if you want to organize, you need to have a solid ground in theory. And you need to have solid discussions and solid discourse. And that's why I think writing in many ways is irrelevant to mobilization. But writing is absolutely crucial to organizing and to social change.